and welcome to Cardicast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. If you'd like to become a member of New Cardigan, head to our website at newcardigan.org. And if you're able to do so, please consider making a donation after you've joined, or maybe even buy a t-shirt. They're pretty swanky. We run entirely on volunteers, so anything that you can do to help us to keep the servers whirring and the Cardies partying is greatly appreciated. This episode features our June Cardi Party from the East Perth Cemeteries. Taking the tour with our Western Australian Cardies is Sarah Murphy, Manager of Interpretations and Collections.
So I'd like to thank the National Trust of Western Australia for hosting this event and letting us, you know, impose on a Saturday. And I'd like to introduce Sarah Murphy, the Manager of Interpretation and Collections, to talk to us about the East Perth Cemeteries.
So how many of you have been here before? Just that side of the room. So it might be something in that. This place is all about segregation, so got you all in that little corner. I'll explain why. It's about segregation very shortly. So the East Perth Cemeteries, you'll see that the name of the site is plural. That's because there were seven individual cemeteries here. It wasn't one. So that's why you'll hear me always talk about the cemeteries, unless I'm talking about a particular cemetery, in which case it's the singular. So it's kind of a key point about this site. This is probably one of the most significant heritage places, particularly in the city of Perth, and I will tell you about this in considerable detail. Hopefully I won't bore you to tears. But I'd really like to make sure that we've got time to have a bit of a wander around as well. And if you've got a particular question about a particular grave site, we can look that up later, because I can't keep all of those in my head. So as Andrew said, I'm with the National Trust of Western Australia, and East Perth Cemeteries is one of almost 70 heritage places we manage in Western Australia. So we have properties from the Midwest, or with Murchison actually Kew, out to Kalgoorlie, down to Israelite Bay and back up again. So we've got, like a lot of not-for-profits, we've got great ambitions and very few resources. So we do what we can with what we've got, but we're not a well-funded organisation. But for those that work in the arts, you know, you'd be familiar with that. Anyway, so this site was one of the first surveyed sites in Perth because there was obviously a great need to bury people. As soon as they die, you can't just leave bodies lying around, so there's an absolute need to bury people quickly. So this site was surveyed in November 1829. And it was surveyed by John Septimus Rowe, who's buried out there. So very early site. And it's actually one of only two colonial burial sites left in a capital city in Australia, the other one being West Terrace Cemetery in Adelaide. So they're pretty rare sites. There were seven separate denominational cemeteries here. There was actually an eighth cemetery as well, but it didn't get much use. It started off being called Cemetery Hill, and it was a general burial site for just general burials because there weren't many people here at that point. But very quickly, there were enough people that there was a need for particular denominations to be buried in their own cemeteries. There was a Methodist cemetery designated in 1830. Then from there on, we had Church of England Cemetery in 1842, Catholic in 1848, Independent in 1854, Wesleyan Methodist in 1854, Jewish in 1867, Presbyterian in 1881, and Chinese in 1888. And then in 1867, there was a cemetery designated for the burial of felons. All of these cemeteries are on this side of the road, except on the other side of Plain Street, Chinese, Presbyterian and Jewish cemeteries, and then the felons were a little bit further west of there. The first burial that was actually here was in January 1830, and that was Private John Mitchell, but we don't have his grave marker anymore, so we don't know where on the site he was buried. But the earliest one that we have a known location for is Louisa Jones, who died in December 1830, but she's got a more recent headstone because when her husband died, the headstone was replaced with his name on it as well. But the oldest grave marker we have is April 1831, and that's for William Stirling, who was the nephew of Governor Stirling, and he's buried over in this Church of England section here. It's been estimated that there are over 10,000 burials here because there were multiple burials in all of the graves. And there's around 700 grave markers left today. So the church we're in is actually a church. It was originally built as a mortuary chapel, Church of England mortuary chapel, and it was consecrated in 1871. It was extended in 1888 and became a parish church. So there is actually a distinction between a church and a chapel, and this is actually a church. So it's still a consecrated church, and it's still used today for services. Hasn't been used for a funeral service for, you know, decades, but it certainly gets used for weddings and other religious services. So going back to the number of burials here, so as I said, there are over 10,000 burials here, many with multiple burials in different graves. There are a lot of areas where you'll see that there, it looks like there are no burials at all, and that's because those headstones have disappeared, or they may never have existed. So a lot of the very early grave markers were made of timber. And for people who are poor as well, they couldn't afford a fancy, expensive headstone. I'll just find a photograph I want to show you. This one is a photograph. I'll pass it around so you can have a look at it. This is in the WA Museum's collection, this one. So it's the only one that actually survives from the original cemetery. You can have a look at that one as I pass around. So those timber grave markers were obviously for people that didn't have much money or a temporary headstone. Some people may never have wanted a grave marker, or there was some anonymity associated with their burial. So there was a big fire that came through here in the 1920s that burned for 2 hours, and it burned all the timber grave markers, it burned the timber memorials, the timber grave surrounds as well, and some of the perimeter fencing. And as I said, it took 2 hours for the fire brigade to get that under control, so it was quite a big fire. The site is a really interesting one to manage, and I'll try not to ramble in too many different directions, but there's so many different things to say about this place that it's a bit hard to just stick to one line of discussion. The cemeteries were all these individual cemeteries were originally separately fenced off as well. So the Catholics were all fenced off and the Presbyterians were off. Everyone was fenced off individually. This photograph from 1939, I'll pass it round, shows you some of the fencing. And you can see in the background here when it comes to you, Perth Girls' School, which is in the corner there. So this photograph is taken from that sort of direction. And you can see the timber fencing around the perimeter of the site from there. This image too, just to give you a greater sense of how the site looked. This was in about, I don't know the exact date, but I think this is about the 1950s. This is the church here where we are now, facing in this direction. This was taken when the Gardens Board managed the site, and you can see there's squiggly paths going through here, and that was because the State Gardens Board decided to beautify the site and turn it into a prettier site than it was. This is one of the really interesting things about this site, that a lot of the cemeteries in Europe were coming into the Gardenesque style of landscape design a little bit later than these cemeteries were opened. So these cemeteries were never designed to have that park-like appearance that you get in a lot of other cemeteries. It was a completely different kettle of fish. And that's because people were living in really difficult circumstances here. They were living pretty much in poverty. The layout of the cemeteries is really interesting. You'll find that the Church of England, being the predominant religious group here, had the most money. So this is the Church of England section in this area, either side of the church, and the memorials tend to be far more substantial and expensive looking than ones, say, for the Catholic section over here. Also, the plantings are different in relation to those as well. As when we go out later, we'll go to the top of the hill, and the biggest memorial for the Munger family is on the top of the hill there. So you can read the hierarchy of everyone. The more expensive graves on the higher real estate, the cheaper real estate down the bottom, very few grave markers at all. So it's as in death, as in life, it's very, very similar. The causes of death in the colony at the time when the cemeteries were first opened were essentially measles, tuberculosis and typhoid and drownings. They were the main things that people died from. There are 35 women that are recorded as having died as a result of or during childbirth, and they're buried here, and 32% of the burials are infants. There was a high sense of child mortality. The average age of the burials is 29 years of age. So when you see people with who are quite old, they were pretty rare. So 29 was the average age. When the gold rushes started in 1890s, there was a huge increase in the number of burials because there were a lot of people in the area. This site became came under more and more pressure, and essentially it was full. So there was a concern about the fact this was full. There was a population increasing around East Perth, the East Perth area, because there were more and more people living here. And there was also a great concern about disease. And in the newspaper, it talked about the possible health hazards coming from here and that noxious matter will gradually drain down from the summit of the hill. So there was great concern about this. And that was one of the reasons why the cemeteries were put here in the first place. It was a long way away from everybody and good drainage, because it's just that real sandy Perth, sandy soil. And so it was a really good spot. So pressure of the population increasing around, concern about disease, and the fact that the cemeteries were becoming full led to the opening of Karakata Cemetery, and these cemeteries closed in 1899. And Karakata was opened at some distance from Perth, is how it was described. It's certainly not like that now, of course. This site also, because of its remoteness, when it was in use, was very, very difficult for funerals to be held, because in the summer they'd have to have the funerals as early in the morning as possible because the horses had so much trouble getting up the hill to get to the cemeteries. Because the commerce was more important than burials, the Perth roads were surfaced in the areas where people were transporting goods and so on, and to get sealed roads out this far wasn't a big priority. So there were a lot of discussions in the newspaper about the poor standard of the roads around East Perth and how they needed to be improved. There's records of pallbearers dropping a coffin just in front of Government House, and that would have been a little bit hard to be dignified when you're dropping the coffin. There's another one from 1867 that talks about a corpse having to be taken out of the hearse and carried up to the burial site because they couldn't get through the sandy soil. And they would use 6 pallbearers instead of 4, the traditional 4, because everyone had to have a turn and have a bit of a break from carrying everybody up the road. You can still see the geography of this. I'm going to show you a photograph that I'll pass around. When you see this, you know, particularly, you know, those of you that know Perth, there was a road that came diagonally up from here called Cemetery Road. It's now called Forest Road. And you'll see on this photograph, this is an aerial view of the city. This is the main roads building, which is in that corner, and that's the cemetery site there. This diagonal road that comes up here was Cemetery Road, and that lined up directly with this church. And the very corner where these apartments are is just slightly truncated even now, because that's where the road came through. So when you see a photograph like that, it just gives you a bit more of a sense of how the landscape is still there to be read. Sometimes you just have to be up very high to read it. So once the cemeteries closed, there wasn't much interest in it at all, and people sort of forgot about it. And there were newspaper reports all through the 1920s and the 1930s about how disrespectful it was that the cemeteries weren't being looked after and that everything was just falling into neglect and ruin. And with that fire that I told you about that came through in the 1920s, that would have accelerated that as well. But certainly then there's the Depression and then the wars, and so looking after this little colonial set of cemeteries wasn't everyone's greatest priority. And so it just got worse and worse and less looked after. By the 1940s, the State Gardens Board was looking after the cemeteries, and the Perth Girls' School was in full operation. They needed more land for the Perth Girls' School for playgrounds for the girls. So the Jewish, Presbyterian and Chinese cemeteries were cleared of their headstones, and those cemeteries were tarmacked to create playing fields for the girls. So that site is still across the road. The Presbyterian grave markers were removed and put into a road reserve here within the cemetery's site. And when we go out, I'll point that out to you. So we've got rows of headstones, but the bodies are still on the other side of the road. The Jewish cemetery is a little memorial park that we still have, but the site where the Chinese and Presbyterian graves are has just been sold and will be redeveloped. And as part of that redevelopment, the new owners need to excavate the bodies, and there'll be a heritage agreement as to how that's done. So my understanding is that there'll be archaeologists that will do that work, and then any human remains will go into an ossuary at Karakata Cemetery. So, and we can see that site when we go outside as well, directly across the road here. So by the 1950s then, the Royal WA Historical Society really agitated for the fact that this place needed to be cared for and really pressured the government into doing something about it. So in 1975, the church was given to the National Trust to manage, and then we took over the entire site in 1994. So we've had it for a while now. It's a very difficult site to manage, and a lot of that is because of the pressures that this site has always had from the urban encroachment around it. This site is important for so many reasons, and it's not just because of the people who are buried here, because they all have their own stories that are really, really interesting. But I'm not going to go into people's individual stories today, because there's 10,000 of them out there and we will be here forever. But this is a really important historical landscape. And we've got some very important plantings here, both in terms of their biodiversity as well as their historical locations, but also just the appearance of the site as well. So this site has now been closed for 117 years, so it's been closed for longer than it was ever in use. So it's most definitely a heritage place as opposed to a cemetery. And it's legally a closed cemetery, so there aren't any burials allowed here. And it's obviously an archaeological site too, so we try to avoid digging holes unless we absolutely have to as well. We allow scattering of ashes, but not interment of ashes. So with this site, the landscape originally was Bankshire woodland, like King's Park. And we have got some photographs. This one that I'll pass around, this is from about 1914. It's looking down below where Gloucester Park is now. Just gives you a bit of a sense of the landscape. As I said, that's 1914, but you can see it's pretty remote. There's not a lot going on there. There's also this other photograph that I'll pass around. I'll pass it in this direction here, Kevin. That's from the 1890s that, again, gives you a bit of a sense of what the landscape looked like. It was very, very rural looking. So with this site, we've tried to keep its 19th century character as much as possible, despite the fact that we're in this city. So, as I said before, when the colonists first came here, they were really fighting for survival. It was a pretty difficult place to live in. There were cash flow problems, there were food shortages, and this didn't really start to improve until the 1840s, but there were a lot of burials in those first 10 years. So, going back to that sense of cemetery design, even though that was coming into fashion in Europe, it wasn't a big priority for them here. So the cemeteries were laid out just as a standard cemetery with everybody in rows, and the burials were done every second one, and then they'd go back and fill in the ones in between. Also, with our really dry climate, having a priority to irrigate this and keeping it looking green is, again, just not a priority, and it would be really hard for us to justify that today as well. So the trees didn't even start to get introduced till the 1860s, so it was pretty much a cleared site, and it's very interesting when you look at the layout of the vegetation patterns even today. In the Church of England section, you'll find that the trees are planted in association with particular graves, so they'll be planted right on the corner of a grave or right in the middle of a grave, and they were likely planted by family members. When you come around to the Catholic section, there's hardly a tree to be seen, so I don't know what they had against trees, but they obviously didn't plant any. There were some plans to build a little chapel in the Catholic section, so on, that never came to fruition, so it might have been an intentional thing not to plant trees that then they were going to have to pull up. That I don't know. But just to give you an example of the types of the way people were living at the time that these cemeteries were in operation, it helps give you a greater sense of why making this look like a picturesque cemetery the way you might expect it today just didn't apply. So the Hester family, there's a memorial for them just out here. They're just one case study of the families that were living here. So the Hesters came out in 1829 with five children. Sophia, the mother, she died in childbirth the following year and the baby died just a few days after her. Her husband, Edward, he wasn't in the best of health himself and he really struggled after she died. Wild dogs killed his sheep and some were stolen and he ended up having to sell any livestock he had left to buy some wheat seed to try to grow a crop and he lost his whole crop in a flood. So he was really struggling with this. The following year, he had to sell all his possessions just to buy enough food to feed his children. In October 1834, he sent a petition to the colonial secretary, Peter Broome, who's buried just out here as well. And what he said was, "Misfortunes have reduced me and my family to a state of misery, which may be more easily conceived than described, being left with five children after all my sufferings, with the greater part of them in a state of nudity around me, wanting bread." So he couldn't even clothe his children. And so if you think, not everyone was obviously living like this, but this man had a really hard time and he wouldn't have been alone. And so for him to come up here and help keep the cemetery looking pretty was just not his priority. As well, the water wasn't even laid on to East Perth until the very early 20th century and even probably later to the cemetery site as well. So even getting water to here wouldn't have been a straightforward exercise. So today, looking at the landscape, the setting itself can easily be confused with neglect and deterioration, which may be partly the case, but it is also a reminder of the social, economic and environmental constraints that people were living in at the time this place was in use. There's also changes that we're aware of that you can still read, but if you know a little bit more about the heritage of the site, it can be still read today. So the layout of the cemeteries is intact, but because we don't have all this individual fencing for each of the cemeteries, it's a bit harder to read that. But we have got some interpretive fencing that we're going to be putting in shortly, just corner sections so that you can see the designation for each of the cemeteries, and that's going in the next few weeks. So you have to come back and have a look at that. A lot of the roads aren't as distinct either. There were quite clear roadways through different sections as well. And this image here that I'll pass around shows the layout of the site a little bit more clearly. So this is the section that was the main cemetery site. On the other side of the road, that corner where there's housing, that was designated for cemetery, but was never used and used for housing pretty early on. The other side of the road, there were orchards, and that looked like it might have been potential places for future burials, but was never used either. So this one just gives it a bit more of a sense of the layout of the site. Last year there was a biodiversity study done by the City of Perth, and the scientists that came up here to have a look were really excited about this place, because it's not had any chemicals put on it or anything like that. So unlike places like Queen's Gardens at the bottom of the hill, it's been fertilised and irrigated and mown and all of that kind of thing, and this site hasn't. So they've found some very rare plants here and they'd like to do more work to see what other little creatures there are around the place that would be very rare within the city to still find. There are male zamias, marri trees, flooded gums, yellow autumn lilies and sandy lilies that are all remnants from the Bankshire woodland. I'm not very good on plants, so don't ask me about those ones. The site, it's still fenced now. The fencing came down in the 1950s but went back up in the 1980s because of vandalism. So while it's not ideal, that's just something we have to live with because we do get vandalism in here. The other key things to point out about this place is about how we manage the site. It's about 4 hectares in size, and we have a small team of volunteers that do the hand weeding of the graves. We can't use whippersnippers or chemicals near the graves. Any chemicals like Roundup and so on work on the basis of a high salt content, and that travels up through the headstones and actually the molecules end up breaking them. So we can't use any chemicals at all. We hand weed because whippersnippers, the line cuts into the edge of the graves and that damages them as well. We do have the site mown, but it costs us $2,500 every time we mow it because we have to use the small domestic size mowers because you have to get in amongst all the graves, and it usually takes about 2 to 3 days for the site to be mowed. So we don't mow it too often because we can't afford it, but also we don't want it to look like a manicured site because it never was historically. So we're not trying to make this look like the lawn section of Karakata. We're actually trying to do the opposite of keeping it looking more rural and remote. It's been described really as being a reverse oasis in the city, that we've got this place, and like today and on Sundays when there's less traffic around, it really has that great sense. You know, it's really hard to think that you're right in the middle of the city. So we have those volunteers. We have another group of volunteers that opens the site to visitors on Sundays. And it's only open for a couple of hours on Sundays because we don't have enough volunteers to open it more, but we'd like to have that more often. We also have it open a lot for schools, and we open for special groups like this one. We don't get huge visitation because we're open fairly constricted hours, but we'd like to increase that. There is a website called eastperthcemeteries.org, and that's managed by the Friends of the Batty Library. And on that website is a burial register of all the burials here. And there's a team of volunteers that work on that consistently, researching death certificates and all sorts of things. Someone hacked into it a couple of years ago, so it's broken at the moment, but they're working on a new website at the moment. So Lottery West gave them a grant to do a new website. So that will be coming up in the next couple of months, the new website for the burials. So that will be really exciting. We've done a few things where we've been trying to broaden our visitation and the types of visitors that we get here. So year before last, we did a program called Sound from the Ground. I've brought the program along for anyone that might want to look at it later, but this is on the National Trust website. You can look this up. The whole program's there and the whole performance is there as well. This was artists in residence who were classical guitarists, and their brief was to research the graves and to develop a repertoire of music based on the stories that the graves could tell. So they chose music from the 16th century through to contemporary music, and then we had two 2-hour performances with them playing. One of the guitarists is a composer. His name's Duncan Gardner, and he composed a piece of music as well for that performance, and that's on our website. That piece of music, it's definitely worth listening to. It's fantastic. It has 8 movements. There's a movement for each of the cemeteries, and there's an 8th movement in recognition of the Aboriginal people of this area. So it's a very powerful piece. Each movement begins with the opening bars, or varies from one to the other, but the opening part of each movement is actually taken from funeral music that was played at funerals at this site, except for the Chinese and Jewish, because there's no funeral music associated with those. We did research into that, and Kayleen helped us a bit with that. But there are musical references to the Chinese and the Jewish traditions in those opening sections. So it's a great piece of music, and it really is. It's highly evocative and really tells of this particular site. At the moment, we're working on a theatre piece that we don't know when we're going to be putting it on, but it'll be later this year, early next year, and it's going to be nighttime performances of theatre outside in the grounds, exploring the site at night with torches, but with actors that will be telling stories about the site too. So we're very keen to get this in use more than just for passive visitation. Most of our visitors tend to be people that are researching family trees and so on, but it's got so much more to it that we'd like to share with people, that we'd like to do more of this, but we're very tight with our resources because there's not many of us and not much money, so that's why we can only sort of do them intermittently, these types of projects. I've just got a couple of other pictures that I'll pass around to you as well. This is an aerial view. As I said, I will be going all around the place a bit. An aerial view of the site showing Perth Girls' School, and it shows the layout of the cemeteries and where the Jewish, Presbyterian, Chinese cemeteries were there, which you can have a look at. This one that shows you as well, a picture of this church in 1829 and when it was used as a parish church. And it's, you know, a bit higgledy-piggledy, but it doesn't look too far different from the way it does today. Also, I think, when was it? Last year, there was some roadworks going on out near the Perth Airport where the new airport link is being created. And we had a phone call from the airport developers to say that they'd found a headstone that came from here. And it's this one. And this is a headstone from 1891. And they were very confused. Their archaeologists did a whole lot of poking around and couldn't work out why a headstone from here was out in Redcliffe. And, of course, it was very easy for us to work that one out because in the 1940s, when the Gardens Board was managing the site, they did a bit of a clean-up, and so if there was any broken headstones or anything like that, they cleaned them up, sent them off, and they were just dumped. You know, and so, obviously, this just was used for fill out near the airport. So we've got this little bit back, and we know where her grave is. It's over by the fence because her father's grave is there, so this would have been a little footer memorial at the foot of the grave. So that was kind of a nice discovery. So we still find things even today. I think they're the main things that I can tell you about with the site, but I'm certainly happy to take any questions or when we go for a bit of a walk around to just point things out to you that I might have mentioned while we were going.
I have questions.
Oh, right.
Well, I had questions until I said I have a question. What you said about keeping the land how it was back in the day, because I'm a cemetery of, you know, appreciator, and the Eurocentric view of, like, you know, Abney Park is that arboreum, like trees everywhere. So when I came in here in January, it was just, it was dry, there was nothing there, and it was quite a shock. But now what you say is like getting rid of that Eurocentric focus, and it makes a lot more sense.
It does, and I guess that's part of the challenge to us at the National Trust is to try to communicate that story to people, because I find that when, yes, as you say, you look at the site and think, oh, it just doesn't look like it's looked after, and in the summer, you know, it's just brown, and we let the grass grow a bit long and all the rest of it. For practical reasons as well as interpretive reasons. But once people understand why it is like this, generally most people get it and they say, oh, right, that's fine. I tend to find older people aren't quite as accepting generally, not everyone, but, you know, some aren't. They still see it as disrespectful that it's not a pretty sight. But also, even if we wanted to do that, to put in irrigation here would cost a fortune. We'd be digging up through people's graves, which wouldn't be ideal. There was some irrigation that was put in either side of this entry driveway a number of years ago, about 15 years ago or so, so that it looked greener for when there were weddings here. That's been disconnected now, but when you go outside, you can see some of the damage that's been created with the water hitting the headstones. So, and then there'd be more watering, we'd then have to mow it more, we'd be facing huge big water bills, and then we'd need to fertilise it, and there's all of these ongoing costs that would just add to that to turn it into a site looking the way it never looked in its history. So there are those practical reasons, but mainly the interpretive reasons that if we made this look pretty, yes, it might look more respectful, but in many ways it wouldn't be so respectful because we'd be actually denying the history of the site and the hardships that the people that were going through that are buried here.
Would there be any plans to revegetate with original vegetation, which would sort of fit in with the...
Well, the vegetation is a really interesting one because, as I was saying before, there are trees that are associated with particular graves, and they're very difficult to manage because the trees are as important as the church and as important as the headstones, but they don't last forever. So we're still grappling with what we're going to do when those particular plants die, because we don't want to necessarily put a tree back in exactly the same spot because of the damage it will do. But if we put it somewhere else, then that changes how you read the site. There's a mix of plantings. There are those early plantings that are remnant vegetation from the 19th century, but then there are more recent plantings that even come through to the 1980s. So we've got this juggling act, which you always get with heritage, is how you juggle these different parts of the history of a site. So we're accepting the fact that we've got remnants from the 1980s here as well and managing those. We also have a sprinkling around of newer headstones where people have put in plaques or something like that to recognise a burial of an ancestor, and we don't permit those anymore because they actually affect how the site looks as well. So we don't allow any new memorials. We've got some other forms for memorialisation rather than that. So we do want to get some of these trees, well, we do what we can to protect the trees we have, and we will be replanting with the same plants that are here essentially rather than introducing anything else.
Sarah, really good outline of how the place worked, but is it clear whether the whole site was cleared before the first burial happened, or did it just quietly chip away into the bush?
Good question, but we don't know. There's really just no evidence of any of that. There weren't even any good burial records. So it's very hard to say whether it was just wholesale clearing and then they put in the burials, or whether they just went section by section. We just don't know. And we probably will never know that. There was
incremental.
Yes, because again, your energies need to go into crops and things like that rather than, oh, we'll get this as a nice cleared site so we're good to go. So it was probably incremental. And with each group doing its own cemetery, they would have just cleared as they needed it, I would imagine, but we just don't know.
Okay, thanks.
I guess that fire sort of cleared everything that...
Yeah, but it was after the site closed, so it didn't really help then. there was also a great character, Mr. Tichbon, who was the sexton here for over 40 years, and I just love his name because he sounds like he's right out of Dickens. And he was in charge of this church and the Church of England. So he would have known where everyone was buried, because when you read the early newspapers, he's in attendance at all these funerals, and there was a very small population, they all knew each other, so he would have known where everybody was. He might not have been able to write either. He came out when he was about 11 years old. So he probably just knew where everybody was. So unfortunately, we know that there are people buried here, but we don't know where. So even in these areas that look like they're empty, they could be buried anywhere in those sites, and we just can't say where people are.
Just a comment, there's a nice symmetry. You said the average age of the persons buried here was 29, which is the age of that wooden marker that was for a man aged 29.
Yes.
There's a nice bit of symmetry there.
Yeah, a well collapsed on him, yes. John Green. Yeah. Yes.
The average man.
That's right.
So I've got one tiny question you may not be able to answer. What does a good death look like for the people buried here? Like, what were the, in general, because there's so many different denominations here, like, what would happen? Like, would they be interred at home, like, for a memorial service and then gone on to some sort of funeral parlour that we recognise today? Or, I mean, you've mentioned hearses and pallbearers and things like that. So is the burial that the people here received much different from what we know today as a traditional burial?
It would have been a real mix, because a lot of it would have depended on people's economic circumstances. Just as today, people died in the Perth Hospital, so it's now Royal Perth. And so there wasn't the refrigeration and so on that we have as well, so they had to do the burials pretty quickly. So everyone was buried generally within a day or two. So people would have gone directly from their homes straight into a coffin and straight to wherever their local church was, if there was a church for them. For this being a mortuary chapel for the Church of England, the bodies would have been brought here for the funeral, but the funeral would have been wherever it needed to be. A lot of these groups as well wouldn't have even had a church early on, so they may very well have just had a graveside service. But a lot of that just isn't very well documented. There are some photographs from the 1890s, and it's a funeral being held by the Bowers of Bower and O'Day, and Bowers are buried just out here as well, with the Chippers, they're out there too. And it's the full-on Victorian hearse with the feathers and the black horses. It's the whole shebang. So I don't think it was until about the 1850s or 60s, not too sure, that there was actually even a hearse available. So there is a photograph here of a man with an open cart. So it's quite possible that the coffins just went straight onto an open cart and got carted up here as such. But a lot of this just isn't very well documented.
If no one has any other questions, thank you so much. That was very interesting.
Thank you.
That was our June Cardi Party touring East Perth cemeteries with Sarah Murphy, Manager of Interpretations and Collections. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you have enjoyed this episode and we'd love you to review us on iTunes. It does help others to find out about CardiCast and let us know that we're on the right track. Keep an ear out for more CardiCasts or hit the subscribe button. You can also check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events, news and merchandise. And remember folks, JFDI.